Welcome, everybody, to Libertarian Ethics Lecture 4. I'm Daniel James Sanchez with the Mises Academy. This is November 18th, 2011. First of all, I'm going to review the topic of last lecture, Mises' theory of society. If you recall, the law of association says that whenever there are any sort of productive inequalities, that means there's always a comparative advantage in production. And wherever there's comparative advantage, and wherever man is aware of it, that there's always possibilities for the greater productivity of the division of labor. And these possibilities are ever present because of the manifoldness of nature, just the fact that human resources and natural resources happen to, as we empirically see, be manifold, be various, heterogeneity pervades the universe. And so that makes for the incentive for social cooperation. And social bonds are very useful because they make for the long-term peace that is necessary for social cooperation and for the benefit of the division of labor. And I made a clarification in the forums, in the discussion forum. There was a great question posted. And one thing I clarified was that social bonds are not about temporary alliances. For example, if it wasn't just about the heterogeneity of society and the greater productivity of the division of labor through continuous dividing of tasks, if it was instead just sort of like opportunities for log rolling and the kind of activities that aren't really based on the variety of human abilities and natural resources, but instead are just sort of economy of scale type things. So for example, two people could be similar to each other, but still benefit from cooperating, for example, with log rolling, that it just takes two people to roll a log. So that cooperation is necessary for the log to be rolled at all. It's not like this big log that half of it can be rolled by one person. It just takes two people to roll the log at all. And those kinds of temporary alliances, Mises believes that those are not the those cannot explain social bonds. That society arises from much more than temporary alliances that could be undertaken and then just dropped. Society is based on continuous cooperation on a day-to-day basis, really. And so because of all this, the division of labor is the fundamental social phenomenon. I have a quote there from Mises. And so the function of social bonds and social order are to make possible and to intensify the division of labor. And because of that, codes of conduct as one kind of social bond, as probably the preeminent kind of social bond, those are also have the function of making social cooperation under the division of labor possible and better. That this explains the origin of property, justice, law, and there's some great quotes from Mises there. And all this matters for us as libertarians because of the power of public opinion. Mises said that any concrete order of social affairs are an outcome of ideologies. The public is primarily concerned with ideologies that deal with living standards, with material, secular welfare. And the power of praxeology is that because the question, of the ideological question that is important to the general public is a matter of means and not individual ends, because mankind, every man considers social cooperation to be the foremost means of his particular individual ends, then the question is open to praxeological and economic analysis. Economics and praxeology have something to say about that. Mises contrasts this to when differences concerning morality and concerning public policy, when those differences have to do with ends, with metaphysical ends, with any kind of ultimate ends. In those situations, praxeology and economics is powerless. You can't really say anything at all. Ultimate ends are unanalyzable given. So two people with two different opposing ends, and this is why Mises doesn't think the way that the scholar Pritchard that David Gordon talked about, why Mises said that Pritchard's view tends towards intolerance, and not only tends towards intolerance, but it tends towards the war that makes intolerance, that arises from intolerance, because there's just nothing to talk about. Pritchard, if you recall, basically said that that people don't realize what the point of morals are, and that morals are just ends in and of themselves. They're not means. I believe that's the thrust of what Pritchard says. And so when you consider something as an ultimate end, the hope for conciliation is very diminished, because ratiocination can't really do anything to make those ends meet. Whereas when you're talking about means, then praxeology and economics has something to say about that, because praxeology and economics are sciences of the means. They are, in one part, I believe it's in Liberalism, Mises calls economics suitability analysis. It's not about judging ends. It enables you to judge the suitability of means towards any given end. And there's an addition that you would have to make to get the complete picture of Mises' utilitarianism. In addition to the division of labor, the doctrine of the division of labor, you might be surprised that the doctrine of Thomas Malthus is also very important for liberalism. In a passage called this is a quote from Theory and History, in a passage called The Utilitarian Doctrine Restated, Mises says, "The essential teaching of utilitarian philosophy as applied to the problems of society can be restated as follows. Human effort exerted under the principle of the division of labor in social cooperation achieves, other things remaining equal, a greater output per input than the isolated efforts of solitary individuals. Man's reason is capable of recognizing this fact and adapting his conduct accordingly. Thus, social cooperation becomes for almost every man the greatest means for the attainment of all ends, all eminently human common interest. The preservation and intensification of social bonds is substituted for the pitiless biological competition, which is the significant mark of animal and plant life. Man becomes a social being. He is no longer forced by the inevitable laws of nature to look upon all other specimens of his animal species as deadly foes. other people become his fellows. For animals, the generation of every new member of the species means the appearance of a new rival in the struggle for life. For man, until the optimum size of population is reached, it means rather an improvement than a deterioration in his quest for material well-being. So this is an additional proviso. Even if there was heterogeneity of resources and human abilities, and man was aware of that, and therefore aware of the greater productivity of the division of labor, even if that was the case, liberalism would still be in a very tough situation if the optimum size of population was already reached. And the optimum size of population is the object of the Malthusian law of population. And Mises discussed that in another part of Theory and History, where he talks about the case of the harmonist. Now, Mises basically refers to the classical liberals as harmonists, in that they believed in the harmony of interests. And so here's the quote: "Those whom we may call the harmonists based their argument on Ricardo's law of association," so that's the part, that's the proviso we're already familiar with, "and on Malthus's principle of population. They do not, as some of their critics believe, assume that all men are biologically equal." So, side note here is that if they did assume that, then the Ricardo's law of association would be null in that case, because there would be no comparative advantage. "They take fully into account the fact that there are innate biological differences among various groups of men, as well as among individuals belonging to the same group. Ricardo's law has shown that cooperation under the principle of the division of labor is favorable to all participants. It is an advantage for every man to cooperate with other men, even if these others are in every respect, mental and bodily capacities and skills, diligence and moral worth, inferior." So now he brings in the Malthusian proviso. "From Malthus's principle, one can deduce that there is, in any given state of the supply of capital goods and knowledge of how to make best use of natural resources, an optimum size of population. So long as population has not increased beyond this size, the addition of newcomers improves rather than impairs the conditions of those already operating." So, and this is what I talked about in my article, The Profound Significance of Social Harmony, that as long as you're underneath the population optimum, you don't have to look at other people as rival mouths, as just another mouth that's competing with your mouth in eating the dwindling means of subsistence. For that reason, people don't have to consume each other in the economic cannibalism that is war, or to snatch from each other like rival packs of hyenas, because animals aren't able to take advantage of the greater productivity of the division of labor. They always have to treat each other as rivals, as really, and not rivals in the social competitive sense, rivals in the biologically competitive sense, in the quest for the means of subsistence. And a lot of times people think that is just a matter of like interspecies conflict, lions eating eating antelopes and antelopes having the nerve of trying to avoid lions and thereby making the lions starve. It's also within the species. If you've ever seen the TV show, what was it? Meerkat Manor on Animal Planet. They talk about meerkat sort of societies, and the rivalry between meerkat, I don't know what you call them, packs or what the term is, but I'll just say packs. The rivalry between meerkat packs is just as deadly as the rivalry between them and predators that prey on them and like bugs that they eat. The meerkats were constantly raiding rival meerkat nests to kill the young because they're rival. There's dwindling means of subsistence, and every additional pack that's not part of the sort of the biological family unit is considered a deadly enemy just by the fact that they're trying to eat. And so that is the situation of animals on a regular basis. And Malthus made the mistake of thinking that people were almost there, almost at that level, that's what he based his iron law of wages on, is that people were just struggling for the means of subsistence, and that they were above a population optimum. But Mises makes the point that people don't have to breed like rabbits, and so since they don't breed like rabbits, they don't have to act like rabbits. They can, through moral restraint, limit their how much they procreate and how much they multiply, and so they can stay below the population optimum. And given the division of labor, and given people taking advantage of the division of labor, mankind has always been under the population optimum, given what's possible if people do cooperate. But if people don't cooperate, it's another matter altogether, and that's where you get the anti-harmonist doctrines of Leben's realm, that you need living space, and so you need to conquer other people, and you need to enslave other people, and even destroy other people. That's sort of the going back into the animal way of providing for yourself, and it doesn't take into account the two great principles that Mises derived from Ricardo and Malthus, the law of association and the law of population. Now I'd like to talk about Mises on consumer sovereignty. So I'm just going to read a passage from Human Action to give you the idea of Mises' doctrine of consumer sovereignty. He says, "The direction of all economic affairs is in the market society a task of the entrepreneurs. Theirs is the control of production. They are at the helm and steer the ship. A superficial observer would believe that they are supreme, but they are not. They are bound to obey unconditionally the captain's orders. The captain is the consumer. Neither the entrepreneurs, nor the farmers, nor the capitalists determine what has to be produced. The consumers do that. If a businessman does not strictly obey the orders of the public as they are conveyed to him by the structure of market prices, he suffers losses, he goes bankrupt, and is thus removed from his eminent position at the helm. Other men who did better in satisfying the demand of the consumers replace him. The consumers patronize those shops in which they can buy what they want at the cheapest price. Their buying and their abstention from buying decides who should own and run the plants and the farms. They make poor people rich and rich people poor. They determine precisely what should be produced, in what quality, and in what quantities. And so Mises refers to the plebiscite of the market, and he refers to every dollar spent as sort of a vote cast for a certain way of arranging the structure of production. Now, this is important, I believe, because you can think of, in terms of economic provision, consumer welfare as public welfare. Because we, as participants in the market, are first and foremost consumers. We are only subordinately producers, because the whole point of production is consumption. And so you can see consumer sovereignty in an isolated case, just a person who is just producing for himself. You can so like if a person was farming, was growing corn, and then he also eats the corn. And if you think of the two functions within the same person, as we call them Crusoe. So Crusoe the farmer and Crusoe the eater. Crusoe the eater can be thought of as sovereign over Crusoe the farmer, because the whole point of him farming was for him to eat in the first place. So his operations as a producer is dictated by his needs as a consumer. I mean, that's just a subjectivist, end-driven way that that Austrian economics looks at action. And then when you expand that to two people, so let's say you have Crusoe as a farmer, and Friday rears sheep, and they trade. They trade with each other. So Crusoe grows corn, and he trades some of his corn to Friday for some wool. Now, in this, even in this really simple market, you could say that Crusoe, the eater, is, in economic terms, sort of sovereign over Friday, Crusoe, the cold person, Crusoe, the person who wants to, who wants a wool jacket, is sovereign over Friday, the wool producer. And Friday, the hungry guy, is sovereign over over Crusoe, the corn producer. So you can see that because they're producing for exchange, they're producing for the other person as an indirect means for their own consumption. But still, there's always that intermediate step. And so, in the economy as a whole, really what's important is consumption. Really, what's important is eating and staying warm and all the consumers' wishes that we want. And so Mises writes that a producer's policy, where you're trying to advantage a particular producer, it might be useful for any given producer to have these perks. But if you put producers' policies on a systemic basis and make it the rule of the way that you organize things, then it just becomes nonsense, because then people just become ossified in whatever productive area they are, and there's no room for improvement, because the whole point is consumption, that if everyone in that kind of situation, everyone would lose as a consumer more than they would gain as a producer. It just doesn't make sense to engineer the economy in a way that it serves every individual's interests as producer, because then they just suffer as consumer, and consumption is the whole point of it. And so for that reason, in economic terms, consumer welfare can be really thought of as public welfare. And so because of that, because the market operates under consumer sovereignty, that is ideal for public welfare, because if consumer welfare is public welfare, then the situation where consumers are sovereign and dictating the way the structure of production is situated and where people are in their roles and who controls the means of production and who controls which means of production and where people situate themselves in terms of for example their labor, then that's really best for public welfare, because if consumer welfare is public welfare, then you want the consumers to be sort of in charge. Now, this raises an issue that Dr. Gordon brought up in the other lecture. He pointed out that it's not completely explicit in Mises' writing that he would have a strong belief in first appropriation homesteading. And one of the slides that I had in my lecture, in my last lecture, I talked about how the classic property order of liberalism involved first user appropriation, so homesteading. So whoever improves a resource, a natural raw resource first, is considered the owner of that. And as Dr. Gordon pointed out, Mises' concern was primarily about property rights being stable and people being free to contract and the market arising from that and consumer sovereignty being sacrosanct because of that. And he didn't come down really firmly on any position about homesteading. And Dr. Gordon also pointed out that that Mises talks about how sometimes the appropriation of goods is so far back in the past that you can't really know, no matter how much you research, there's no way that you're going to find out how the good was originally appropriated. So if you trace a good back through various exchanges all the way back through time, in his book Socialism, he says that eventually you either get to a point where it was appropriated out of nature or it was expropriated from a person. And what Mises was trying to defend there was he was trying to defend the principle of private property, because some critics said that that the institution of private property was bad because a lot of private property could eventually be traced back to a point of expropriation from one person and another. From another, and Mises was making the case that that doesn't show that the institution of private property itself is a bad one, and what he was saying is that if you can't trace it that far back, and you can't show whether it was peacefully appropriated from nature or if it was violently expropriated from another person. If you can't show one way or the other, it still makes sense to, like Dr. Gordon said, to consider any given person who is controlling the good as a presumptive owner of the good. However, while it's not explicit, I do think that while it's not explicit that he says this, I do think that Mises, it's hard to imagine that Mises would be ambivalent about situations where you can trace it to whether it was appropriated from nature or expropriated from a person. So, for example, if you could trace it to a point where you could determine, oh, well, this resource was expropriated from the original improver of the good a long time ago, I don't think he would be he would just say, who cares about that kind of situation. I think consumer sovereignty is still concerned with the way that goods are appropriated. I think it matters for the consumers whether people just whether the ownership, the train of ownership starts from a point of expropriation or from a point of appropriation from nature. And in my article about the basics of property, I talk about David Hume's justification of Lockean homesteading. Now, John Locke has the classic formulation of mixing labor with the land, and that because you own your labor, then you mix your labor with the land, and so since your labor is now intermixed with the land, that means that you own the land too, that you have improved. And so it seems a kind of a poetical justification. And I remember in one of David Gordon's lectures on the history of political philosophy, he talked about the counter argument that says, like, well, what if you, you know, own a bottle of wine and you empty your bottle of wine into the ocean or into a large lake and it intermixes with, you know, well, if you consider the lake a lake, eventually maybe it would diffuse through the entire lake. Does that mean you then own the lake just because you dumped your wine in there, or does that mean that you lost your wine? And most people would say it means that you lost your wine. So that argument, the way of formulating it is a curious one, I believe, and I much prefer Hume's simple justification. He says that, let me see, find the quote. He said, who sees not that whatever is produced or improved by a man's art or industry ought forever to be secured to him in order to give him encouragement to such useful habits and accomplishments. And Hoppe also makes a good sort of, even though he wouldn't call himself utilitarian, a utilitarian case for homesteading, that he says that any deviation from the set of rules of, that involve homesteading and contracting and ownership of the product implies by definition a redistribution of property titles and hence of income away from user producers and contractors of goods onto non-user producers and non-contractors. As a consequence, any such deviation implies that there will be relatively less original appropriation of resources whose scarcity is realized. Appropriation matters. The bringing out of resources from a state of nature into becoming improved and becoming useful for human human purposes, that's an important part of the whole economic process. So if you consider that within the whole economic process, and if you imagine that there still is a lot of virgin land out there, it does matter in terms of economic welfare how that is brought into appropriation. And if people are not secure in what they originally appropriate, then they're going to appropriate less. They're going to be less careful with what they appropriated. Just all the utilitarian cases for property are still applicable in terms of property and how it's brought out of nature just as much as it is in terms of property and how it's exchanged in contracts. So I think even though Mises wasn't explicit on his homesteading theory, and he never talked about, like, oh, well, you know, what are the limits of, as far as I know, he didn't talk about it, what are the limits of, like, for example, there were some people in colonial America who would just go around with an axe and just, like, chop into trees, just run around chopping into trees and say, okay, well, I improved all these trees, so all this whole forest is mine now. And so obviously it wouldn't be very utilitarian for those people to be able to just do that and appropriate huge swaths of land, even though they didn't really improve it very much at all. And so so there is a lot of theoretical discussion that can be had over the issue of homesteading, and Mises didn't go into those questions. Rothbard and Hoppe did a lot more, but I think there can be a very strong utilitarian arguments for Hoppe's and Rothbard's conclusions. They really seem to make sense, and indeed Hoppe himself sort of makes a utilitarian argument for a certain way of homesteading. Okay. Thoughts raised by Dr. Gordon's lecture. I already talked about the fact that being a Misesian utilitarian doesn't mean that you have to be a minarchist like Mises is. Hazlitt and Mises, I'm going to talk about that later. Hoppe and Hume's Law, I already talked about that. The issue of let's go down to the words arbitrary and whim. This is one way of criticizing utilitarianism is that if you consider people's ends as unanalyzable givens and whether you know, killing babies is wrong or not, or sport killing, or whether expropriating from someone is wrong or not. Since those are value judgments, and so there's no such thing as a scientific ought, so you can't declare a given value judgment as correct and another value judgment as incorrect. The critics say, well, if you consider the state of affairs that way, then you think of value judgments as arbitrary, or that could be based on a whim. And so a lot of times the comparison is given to ice cream flavors. That they say, well, that puts questions of right and wrong on the same plane as whether you prefer vanilla or chocolate ice cream. And I think that's a little unfair, because there's definitely a continuum of value judgments. For example, between ice cream flavors and what's right and wrong, you might ask, oh, who is a better musician, Beethoven or Rebecca Black, the author of the writer, the singer of the YouTube sensation, really, really so bad it's good song, Friday is called. I don't know if you're familiar with Rebecca Black, but she has just this really obnoxious nasal voice, and it's a really lame song, and really silly lyrics and really silly music, and there are value judgments that are still subjective, and they're still, you can't say that, you know, someone who actually prefers Rebecca Black is technically incorrect, but because there are certain sentiments that are so universal among people, and there are certain judgments about what's generally useful that are so almost unanimous among people and so strongly held by individuals that they can seem almost like objective truth. And but then at the same time, there are value judgments like ice cream where it really is a whim. And a whim kind of implies that you're kind of ambivalent. You're that like, well, I could like chocolate, but I kind of prefer ice or vanilla, so ultimately I'm going to go that way. Whereas in situations, considerations of, for example, Beethoven versus Rebecca Black, a lot of people would not consider that as sort of an indifferent case. That is, you're very strongly in one camp. And so most people, when it comes to questions of right or wrong, because they realize the social utility and because they've been raised by decent parents and have been always taught very firmly that murder is wrong, that stealing is wrong, and all these things, then people obviously don't think of those kinds of questions as whims. It's not like, well, I could murder him, but I kind of prefer not to. On Tuesdays, I don't like to murder people. I mean, that's the kind of attitude that you imagine when you say the word whim. And you say the word arbitrary, and that's obviously not the way that people think of moral rules, and it makes it seem like utilitarians assume that people think of moral rules in that way when you use the words arbitrary and whim. So that's just kind of a pet peeve of mine. Right, Justin says, you better hope Jeffrey Tucker doesn't hear what you said about Rebecca Black. And yeah, Jeffrey Tucker is really incredible because he is very broad-minded because he really enjoys Rebecca Black, probably in a tongue-in-cheek kind of way, but at the same time, he's a huge fan of classical music. Right? He's really into choral music in particular. So he can kind of have the refined sensibility, but is broad-minded enough to indulge in that kind of music as well. I also wanted to make a distinction between Mises's. I want to clarify what Mises meant by happiness, by the words happiness, and also distinguish that from what Rothbard discussed when he talked about flourishing. So here's a quote from Human Action about happiness. Praxeology is indifferent to the ultimate goals of action. Its findings are valid for all kinds of action, irrespective of the ends aimed at. It is the science of means, not of ends. It applies the term happiness in a purely formal sense. In the praxeological terminology, the proposition, man's unique aim is to attain happiness, is tautological. It does not imply any statement about the state of affairs from which man expects happiness. So it doesn't make any kind of suppositions about concrete states of affairs that men want. It's tautological, just whatever man's aim is, whatever an individual man's ends are, that is just called happiness. But then in another part of Human Action, seven chapters later, he distinguishes between what economics and praxeology says about happiness and what liberalism, which applies economics and praxeology, what that says, what that means when it refers to happiness. While praxeology, and therefore economics too, uses the term happiness and removal of uneasiness in a purely formal sense, liberalism attaches to them a concrete meaning. It presupposes that people prefer life to death, health to sickness, nourishment to starvation, and abundance to poverty. Okay? So with the praxeological, economic, tautological sense, happiness can include the ends of an ascetic, or the ends of a sadist. So if someone wants to like blow up the world or something, or if someone wants sit on a huge column, the way that some saints did in early Christian days. And there was one saint who, there was a maggot who was eating like an open wound on his arm or something, and the maggot fell off, and then he actually put the maggot back in the wound and said something like, "Eat what God has given you." And so it's ascetics like that, even for them, the happiness that economics and praxeology talk about include those kinds events. But with the happiness that liberalism is talking about doesn't include that. It particularly refers to people preferring life to death, health to sickness, nourishment to starvation, and abundance to poverty. And again, this presupposition is empirically justified, because empirically we see that the vast majority of people are primarily concerned with those things, and since the ideology that actually prevails and becomes the new social order depends on the wants and the ideology of the vast majority, then those are the preferences that matter in terms of what social order is actually effectuated. Now, Rothbard's flourishing is a bit different from both senses of happiness. His flourishing ultimately is independent of social cooperation and the greater productivity of labor. Rothbard talks about flourishing even before he introduces Friday onto Crusoe's island, even when it just came to the matter of Crusoe himself. For example, in Ethics of Liberty, Rothbard talks about, like, well, what if Crusoe wanted to eat poisonous mushroom for kicks? Rothbard says that would actually be unethical. And this is actually distinguished to a degree from the Hoppe himself, because Hoppe really thinks about ethics and morals and the rules of morals as being fundamentally about interhuman relations and about dealing with scarcity and avoiding conflicts over scarcity. But Rothbard actually makes it more basic, down to the level of even one person. That he contends that in some cosmic way, a person who eats poisonous mushrooms for kicks is not just being, obviously he's not being antisocial, but because there's no society to speak of, it's just one person, but still that's somehow, that's against his nature. And so because it's against his nature, it's against the essence of what it means to be a human, that would be not flourishing, and so that would be unethical, he would say. So it's different from Mises' conception of happiness, which in under liberalism. Which under praxeology and economics has to do with just whatever the person wants. So if a person wants to eat poisonous mushrooms and, you know, revel in, even if it's just to revel in the sensation of the high of the poisonous mushrooms in a few moments before you die, well, then that's what he wants. And economics is a value-free science, and it just takes ends as given, and that's just the formal definition of happiness in that situation. And in terms of liberalism, the happiness of liberalism is the happiness that is made possible by the greater productivity of the division of labor. And obviously, in this case, there's no division of labor to speak of. So liberalism has nothing to say about Crusoe in complete isolation on this island. So that's an important distinction. Some notes about Hazlitt. Now, in one sense, it might be thought that Hazlitt tries to refute Hume's law, but it's a way of refuting. It's a way of considering Hume's law that of considering the term ought in a way that really no utilitarians have a problem with, because it's the instrumental ought. It's the ought of, if you want A, you should do B. Like, B is a suitable means for A. And that's completely a value-free version of the ought, because it's just talking about means, adjusting means to ends. It's not talking about the justification of the ends themselves. So, and I think David Gordon went into that also. There is a degree to which Hazlitt falls for the parachuting ethicist fallacy. There are some passages in Foundations of Morality where Hazlitt says that ethics can tell the person, and it seems to imply that it can tell the person on the spot what is in his enlightened self-interest. And again, the utilitarian of Mises, utilitarianism of Mises, is not about that. It's about changing public opinion. It's about changing the prevailing ideology, and that having its effect on individual conduct in concrete situations. It's not about directly making arguments for specific concrete situations. So, for example, he talks about the lobbyist who lobbies for perks, for subsidies, and Mises says that, like, yeah, in a situation within a generally pro-subsidy environment, people are going to argue for subsidies. People are going to seek out subsidies. And if that's the general ideology, that subsidies are economically make sense, then individuals are going to go for that. And he says it's not really up to the individual rent seeker on the spot to realize the general social disutility of that kind of thing. It's up to public opinion in general to prevent those kinds of things from happening, from affecting what's basically a moral revolution. Common law versus social rationalism. This is another difference between Hazlitt and Mises, and actually a way in which Mises has more in common with Rothbard than with Hazlitt. Hazlitt is more sympathetic to common law and traditions, discovering the best moral rules through experience, through trial and error, whereas Rothbard, like David Gordon said, believes that that laws that arise from common law, that they need to be held up to the standard of reason. And of course, for Rothbard, the reason involved is reasoning concerning natural law. Mises would agree with Rothbard that the fact that something has arisen through common law is not in and of itself a justification of the law. He also disagrees with legal positivists, sharing this with Rothbard, in saying that laws can be critiqued by a standard outside the law itself, not just by critiquing, well, whether it is within the legal code or not. But, of course, Mises's standard by which you should use reason to critique the common law is social utility, and he believes that that ultimately it is ideologies that concerning social utility that do determine moral rules. Hazlitt has a great section about the whole idea of let justice be done, though the world be destroyed, and he brings that up as an example of like, well, do people really believe that? Like, would they take it to that logical conclusion? And so that kind of gets at whether justice is an end in itself or if it's a means. And so Mises says that the utilitarian doesn't say that. He says, let justice be done so the world will not be destroyed, so that, you know, people will be happy on the world. Hazlitt has a great chapter on general rules that I assigned. He really brings out the fact that Hume was a great theorist of rural utilitarianism, long before utilitarianism was actually adopted by John Stuart Mill and propagated by John Stuart Mill. Hume actually had a much stronger, a much more robust formulation of utilitarianism than even Bentham and Mill did later on. And one way that it was stronger is that it did recognize the importance of general rules as opposed to act utilitarianism, which, like the Chicago School of economics, when they're talking about deciding property rights based on wealth maximization in a given instance, that's act utilitarianism. And Hume makes the point that sometimes when you follow a general rule, in individual cases, there could be sort of a net bad effects and of course this can't be quantified. It has to be a phenomenological judgment of whether it's a net bad effect, historical psychic judgment. But for example, restoring, like say that there's a person who always uses his money in like making little girls cry, he spends his money on like scary faces that goes around making little girls cry, and so someone restores his money to that someone like pays a debt to that person, and that person uses that money that he gets from the debt to go around causing suffering, not breaking any property rights, but just in general causing suffering. And yeah, in that one instance, you could say kind of reasonably that, you know, using historical judgment, that in general that act of justice of restoring that person what was owed to him did bring a lot of suffering into the world. But you can't just like make exceptions all the time for all these, like, well, you can justify anything that you want. But what's important is that the systemic tendency, the systemic outcomes of the rule in question, and the systemic outcome of restoring people what is owed to them is so overwhelmingly positive that you have to consider the utility of the rule as so important that you keep the rule as sacrosanct. Even if there's a possibility that in particular cases you could make the case that utility wasn't maximized. And again, maximization not in a quantitative sense, just in a historical human judgment kind of sense, the kind of judgment that we make all the time. Okay, running out of time here, but I just wanted to talk a little bit more about Hazlitt. Find the quote I wanted to bring out from Hazlitt here. Oh, I had it, but I went to the wrong page. This is from his chapter on on concerning the ethics of capitalism, and he talks about property. He says about the institution of property. The question that concerns us here, however, is not the antiquity of the institution, but its utility. When a man's property rights are protected, it means that he is able to retain and enjoy in peace the fruits of his labor. This security is his main incentive, if not his only incentive, to labor itself. If anyone were free to seize what the farmer had sown, cultivated, raised, the farmer would no longer have any incentive to sow or raise it. If anyone were free to seize your house after you had built it, you would not build it in the first place. All production, all civilization rests on recognition of and respect for property rights. A free enterprise system is impossible without security of property as well as security of life. Free enterprise is possible only within a framework of law and order and morality. This means that free enterprise presupposes morality. But as we shall later see, it also helps preserve and promote it. So even just in that, on that basic level, property has is so utilitarian, so superior in each utilitarian sense. But then when you expand that into capitalism, when just simple primitive exchanges evolve into capitalism, then the benefits of property rights begin to compound. Because like I mentioned about consumer sovereignty, that you have consumers determining the structure of production, and so there's a part where Hazlitt talks about the distribution theory of John Bates Clark. So if you look for Bates Clark in the Foundations of Morality, you'll find that passage, and John Bates Clark talks about how under capitalism, every factor of production, every laborer, every owner of capital, they each are get the what Rothbard calls the discounted marginal value product, that they receive their contribution to production. And so it encourages workers and property owners to integrate themselves into the structure of production in a way that that maximizes their marginal product, because that in turn maximizes their income. And so it's the opposite of moral hazard. It's where incentives are just completely lined up. And then there's another sense in which the utility is compounded, that calculation is made possible. Economic calculation is only made possible with private property and the means of production. And economic calculation is what makes rational, as Mises says in his discussion of the calculation problem of socialism and the calculation feature of capitalism, is that economic calculation is what makes possible rational adjustments of the means of production to consumer wants. And so there's just so many ways that the utilitarian benefits of private property compound as the economic system becomes more complex. And I have some critiques of Hoppe and Rothbard, but since we're 5 minutes over, I will save that for the last lecture. So if people have questions, please post them in the Q&A panel. It's a lot easier for me to read them there, because it doesn't keep scrolling up and down every time someone posts something. Okay, so Leslie Webb says, I think act utilitarianism is more amenable to quantification than rule utilitarianism. For example, we can quantify the benefits of a single act of eminent domain, but it seems impossible to quantify the utility or disutility of the practice of eminent domain. So it seems the Chicago School of economists would have to be economic act utilitarian, given their commitment to quantitative economics. That's a great point. That their methodology kind of leads them to that approach, because even though their methodology is still completely invalid, even with this approach, it at least is you can seem to be saying something meaningful a lot more when you talk about given instances than when you talk about rules as a whole. Whereas rule utilitarianism is much more amenable to the Mises-ian understanding of historical judgment, of non-quantitative historical judgment of outcomes of situations and ends and general happiness. Because you can understand as someone who uses what Mises calls the specific understanding of thymology, you don't need quantitative data to just perceive the difference between North Korea and South Korea, that you can just understand as a historian the difference between North Korea and South Korea, and how any person would prefer would likely be better off in the economy of South Korea than in the economy of North Korea. Charles Devan asks, is consumer sovereignty currently abrogated? And if so, to what degree? And yes, whenever there is any kind of producer's policy, that is an abrogation of consumer sovereignty. So whenever there is a restrictive tariff in favor of any particular producer, whenever there is regulations that make it difficult for new competitors to enter the field, and when that's done for the sake of vested interests of old producers, that is an abrogation of consumer sovereignty. And in those kinds of situations, as Mises says, each individual in the system, each individual loses as a consumer far more than he gains as a producer. And again, this can't be a quantitative judgment. It's a qualitative historical judgment based on the state of affairs that you can reason will happen through economics, through economic reasoning. Consumer sovereignty is abrogated all the time on the hampered market. Any other questions? Do I agree with Rothbard's view that Malthus was an anti-natalist? I would have to say I don't know. I have not read Malthus's original works to the extent for me to make that judgment. I think it goes along with his views on population. His general views on population, it is definitely complementary to the iron law of wages and his idea of the population optimum but I wouldn't be able to say for certain if Rothbard made that conclusion. I would tend to assume that Rothbard is correct, because I'm sure he's read Malthus through and through. Are there any contemporary works by economists or philosophers continuing in the utilitarian ethics tradition of Mises? Yes, there is Leland Yeager. He's kind of, someone corrected me, I thought of him as an Austrian economist, but someone corrected me on the blog, said that he's actually kind of a neoclassical economist, so I don't know, but I know he's generally he's kind of associated, he is a fellow traveler of Austro-libertarian, and he is definitely a utilitarian sort of in the Mises Hazlitt camp. There are a lot of ACT utilitarian, like the Chicago School, and that would be a very, very different from the tradition of Mises. There aren't a lot. Rothbard really kind of won the day with this whole debate. That it's pretty much every Austro-libertarian scholar that you can think of. Some of them might have a general utilitarian inclination that they don't really talk about, like, theories of ethics. They don't really talk about argumentation ethics or natural rights, and they generally make economic arguments that are basically utilitarian, but they don't really go into, like, the philosophy of utilitarianism and the analysis of utilitarianism very much. Even though they kind of use it, and I would say that a lot of non-utilitarians use utilitarian arguments. I mean that's kind of gets at a question that I have, and I can actually go to the one slide that I was going to talk about. That so in Hoppe's intro to the Ethics of Liberty, he talks about the integration of economics and natural political philosophy into a unified science of libertarianism. But that raises the question for me, without utilitarianism, what does economics have to do with libertarianism? It just strikes me as sort of interesting that even though a huge proportion of libertarians these days aren't utilitarian, yet they seem to be really, really interested in economics. They seem to somehow think that economics has a lot to do with libertarianism. They think it's really important to learn, and its conclusions are really important. But what I don't understand how they are important without utilitarianism. I mean, you could imagine someone who subscribes to natural law ethics, and you know they could do an analysis of the implications of price theory and what happens in the economy when you set price ceilings and when you set price floors and when you restrict production in various ways but then at the same time it's like, well, why go through all that trouble when you can just say, like, at the very beginning, well, it was aggression anyway. So that's really what matters. That, like, oh, well, yeah, all this aggression happened and these other consequences did happen, but if those consequences don't matter, and if just the bare fact of the aggression having occurred is what matters, like, what's the point of all this analysis? Why not just point out, oh, that there was aggression and that's aggression and that's aggression? I don't understand why people who are so critical of utilitarianism are at the same time so interested in economics. So I also, in Rothbard's preface to Ethics of Liberty, he talks about economic unfortunate consequences, and then he refers to man economy in state and power in market, and how in those books he traces out the unfortunate consequences. But I mean, how can you call those unfortunate just from economic analysis? I mean, I thought that he would then say, like, oh, well, they were unfortunate because of natural law analysis, but he made it sound like he had demonstrated in his economics work that they were unfortunate consequences through economics. But I just don't understand how that fits. And there's also a part where he says economics can supply much of the data for a libertarian position. That he never made it clear to me, at least, how is this data for the libertarian position? Because again, the data for the libertarian position and the natural rights approach is just the bare fact that aggression has occurred, and like the economic analysis of what is the outcome of that aggression. I don't understand how in the natural rights approach that is data for the libertarian position. And so that's a question that I have, and Dr. Gordon and students, if you have any insight into that, I would much appreciate that. Any other questions? Okay, so Dr. Gordon asks, why do you think that someone who isn't a utilitarian can't care about consequences? Non-utilitarians think that consequences aren't everything. This does not imply that they count for nothing. Well, I mean, I just wonder if you've already proven with natural rights philosophy that a certain act is just undesirable and wrong, then what if economics like came to a different conclusion? Then it would seem that if you're really in the natural rights camp and not a utilitarian, then you would say, well, it's the natural rights that matters. I wonder, is it when you say that consequences aren't everything, but they are something, is it that they are something because they can be used to convince people who are utilitarian, so that on their own grounds they can be convinced, even though that they shouldn't be utilitarian? And Rothbard does basically say that any kind of utilitarian argument presupposes that, he says that whenever you're making any kind of policy recommendation, that it does presuppose some kind of an ethical norm. So that it does presuppose an ethical but he says that most people do that willy-nilly. So he even goes so far as to say that economists who have not derived a theory of ethics, some kind of theory of ethics, that they should just shut up about policy, that they shouldn't make any, he actually says, I forget which part of economic controversies, which paper it's in, but in one of those papers in economic controversies, he says that economists who have not derived a theory of ethics, some sort of positive scientific theory of ethics, should not even make policy recommendations at all. So, I mean, what's amazing about that to me is that the implications of that approach would seem to mean that Rothbard would have said that Mises shouldn't be talking about policy at all, because Mises didn't. He had utilitarianism as a practical approach, but he didn't have a positive, what Rothbard would call a positive theory of ethics. So it seems that by that standard, Rothbard would say that Mises should never have talked about policy. And that's hard to imagine Rothbard actually following through with saying. And so without natural law ethics, since utilitarianism, I don't believe Rothbard considers utilitarianism as a standalone ethical doctrine. So using that stricture that Rothbard imposes on people in making policy recommendations, that they have to have some kind of positive theory of ethics to make policy recommendations at all, that would seem to preclude utilitarian arguments, because it would seem that there wouldn't be arguments at all. That there would just be statements of consequences, and that ultimately it falls upon natural law ethics or he was also sympathetic to argumentation ethics, some positive theory of ethics to even make any kind of judgment on policy. Next. Can't non-aggression principles and utilitarianism be complementary and reinforcing? To do what is right is to do what is good, and to do what is good is to do what is right. But then there's the whole question of, I mean, non-aggression principles, I don't think non-aggression principles are anti-utilitarianism. I think utilitarianism integrates non-aggression principles, because it's not against principles. The utilitarian believes you need these rules as principles, not as just like ad hoc, let's just see what the utility of the specific act happens to be and judge based on that. As a rule utilitarian, Mises is for principles. Rules are principles, that even before you know the concrete facts of any given instance, just you can say that this violates the principle that if you follow has a systemic tendency for the greatest social utility, so for the sake of social utility, you shouldn't violate that principle. So utilitarians are for principles, but it doesn't treat the act of aggression as just sort of the analysis of just the bare facts of the matter as enough to really get at the heart of the issue, that the reason why this type of action is considered undesirable is because of the systemic consequences that come from it, and that's why you have a certain property regime, and that's why you have a certain definition of aggression as violation of property rights and that's why you have the definition of liberal property rights as being situated in the way it is. And so when you say to do what is right is to do what is good, well, is that just a coincidence? Is one thing caused by the other? And the utilitarian would say that we call what we consider right, because of its systemic tendency to do good. Dr. Gordon says, I think the non-utilitarian point here would be that good consequences have moral weight, but aren't the only thing that fits. But I don't see that in Rothbard. I don't see good consequences having any moral weight in his analysis. And maybe I'm missing some passages. But I don't see the consequences, especially given the ends of an individual person or the ends of most people taking in consideration as being the standard. Like he has sort of a more like cosmic standard of like, well, it's against his nature, it's against the way that humans tend towards, and it's against human flourishing in this non individualistic sense, this non human end sense, that he has this sort of more Aristotelian, broader view of ends, where he talks about ends that like actual material entities have ends, that like a cult has the tendency towards becoming a full grown horse, and so that is the end of the cult, and so that's a very broader, much broader use of the word end that Mises uses, and that like hydrogen and atoms have a tendency to behave in a certain way, so they have so even just dead material objects, Rothbard says they have ends too. I remember a particular passage where he really makes that claim, and so those are the kinds of ends that Rothbard talks about when he gives moral weight to things. And so he talks about humankind, what the human entity, what causes, what is flourishing for the human entity in that much more broader definition of end, of end being that which a thing tends toward, not that which a thing desires, not which a human desires. And So I don't see where he ever gives good consequences moral weight. So the former point explains why Rothbard thinks economic arguments about the benefits of the market are ethically relevant. Yeah, I just don't see that, because he puts it at the very beginning of his analysis, what is right and what is wrong, that he derives property rights, at least from my understanding, that he derives the whole notion of property rights just from Crusoe by himself. He doesn't consider sort of the economic ramifications of the greater productivity of the division of labor and of economic consequences. In the Ethics of Liberty, he doesn't say like, okay, well, economics teaches us that these consequences are systemic, and so these consequences should be desired by man, and so you can use natural rights to say that, oh, man should want what is economically more productive, and economics teaches us that this is more productive. He doesn't say that. The division of labor and all that is kind of besides the point. He never integrates the economic consequences of various policies. It's much more basic. It starts at the very beginning of just Crusoe and what is the nature of Crusoe and what he defines as human flourishing, and then he works up from there. So he never really talks about the moral weight of economic consequences, as far as I can see. So Charles says, is it not true that Rothbard and Mises signify different concepts altogether by the use of the term ethics and morality? Rothbard seemed to view ethics as something to be discovered, whereas Mises viewed morality as a human precept. Yes, I think that's a good distinction to make, that Rothbard viewed ethics as something to be discovered, even within a single person, and just Crusoe alone on this island, that it can be discovered what is, through right reason, what the good for man is, just by analyzing Crusoe alone on his island. Whereas Mises viewed morality as a human precept that is devised in order to make the division of labor. So it involves Crusoe and Friday necessarily, and more, to make the greater productivity of the division of labor and the human happiness that social cooperation makes possible, to enable that to occur. So it's 32 after the hour, but if anyone has any last questions, please feel free to post them. I'm really curious if people disagree with me. I mean, if anyone, especially Dr. Gordon, if I've misinterpreted Rothbard in this way, if somehow he does place moral weight on economic consequences, on like if he places moral weight on the consequences of price fixing, and the consequences, if he integrates his economic analysis that he writes so well about in Man, Economy, and State, and Power and Market, and into his ethical conclusions, I'd really like to see that, but I haven't yet in my reading of Rothbard. Okay, well, since we're over time and I haven't seen any questions. Oh, thank you, Matthew. I'm glad you enjoyed the lecture. We can call it a night. So thank you, everyone, for attending. And I will see you guys at Dr. Gordon's lecture. Remember, we're going to take a break for Thanksgiving, because the next Thursday is Thanksgiving, so obviously we're not going to have a lecture on Thanksgiving. So the next lecture will be with Dr. Gordon on the ethics of HAPA. Oh, thank you, Dr. Gordon. On the ethics of HAPA, so that will be definitely be really fascinating, because HAPA has really bold, strong, innovative views on ethics. So that'll be a great exploration to see, and David Gordon gave a great lecture on HAPA's ethics in his Libertarianism and Modern Philosophers course, and so it'll be great to see that analysis of HAPA's ethics. thank you, everybody, and see you in 2 weeks. Bye.